Welcome to the Clarity Fund podcast. I'm Dr. Owen Anderson, and this is episode 9. I'm joined today with Dr. Kelly Burton, and we're going to be doing a series together about mentoring young philosophers. And we have some ideas about this because we've both been in philosophy for some time. It's somewhat humorous to say mentoring young philosophers, because by saying that, you're accepting that you're not young. You're in some sense old. And both of us will talk a little bit about our careers and our schooling, or our background. I've been through the Secular Academy at all levels of my degrees up to PhD, and I've been working at the Secular University, Research University, tenured there, now full professor. So I'm coming to this out of that background, having been spent both my student career and my professional career in the Secular Academy, and thinking about what are some of the challenges that face young philosophers, and maybe especially young Christian philosophers. And Dr. Burton, very similar, right? You've been through the Secular Academy. Your career has been in the Secular Academy.
Yes. And do we want to mention numbers of years when we do this? Because it really has added up. And,
yeah.
We feel young, but I guess we're in the position of being leaders now. And I went to Arizona State University and got several degrees there in the Secular Academy. And I've been teaching for almost 18 years. And there have been challenges along the way. But that's why we're here. We want to help younger people with facing those challenges.
Yeah. Yeah. Same for me. I've been teaching roughly 20 years, and we've both been in school, obviously even longer than that. And so we've been doing philosophy for a while, and we've been through challenges, right? I mean, there's been questions about how we teach philosophy that are raised, if you're able to teach philosophy that way, et cetera. So because we've done that, we've been working in the areas of reason and faith. We're both interested in kind of laying out some of the field that new, younger persons will be encountering. What kind of challenge will they be looking at? So I know, for example, in your case, you've done work on Plantinga.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And maybe we can talk about that, and what challenges were you addressing? What attracted you to Alvin Plantinga's work to focus your graduate studies on that, and then you have a book out on that?
Yeah, well, I didn't go to Plantinga directly. What happened was, when I went to Arizona State and started to study philosophy, I encountered skepticism, and I know you did too. We can't really know anything. And I took this personally because I thought we could know things. I was going with Socrates. He seemed to be pursuing knowledge. So I struggled with skepticism. And my professors, I think, saw that and directed me towards Plantinga as possibly providing an answer. So I spent my master's degree studying Plantinga, particularly his epistemology. And I didn't really find an answer to skepticism there. I found maybe fideism. And so
another kind of fideism.
Yeah, I focused on...
Maybe we could distinguish sophisticated fideism and simple fideism, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was sophisticated fideism. It wasn't like he came out and said, "Well, nobody can really know," but it ended up that way. And so I did struggle with that. And I think that's how we ended up here, is we wanted an alternative.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the episodes you and I will do together, is going to be about skepticism and fideism. And so it's interesting, we're going through, you mentioned Socrates, and there are certain things that stand out in philosophy as a field, right? And Socrates is one of them. In a way, he's the father of philosophy, even though he's not the first philosopher, but he gives us certain attitudes and examples, like the unexamined life is not worth living.
Right.
Or pursuit of knowledge through dialogue, asking questions. But I think every philosopher would hold up Socrates to some extent, and yet they might get different lessons out of him, right? They might say, Socrates teaches us that what's important is an attitude of wanting to know, while we realize we'll never know anything.
Yeah.
And so what I'm wondering about is, can we sort of identify how to get through that kind of attitude, right? This skeptical attitude, and whether or not Socrates was a skeptic. In one way, that's kind of a question about the historical Socrates.
Right.
My reading of him is, He's at the beginning of his mission is to find knowledge. And at that point, he says, I know that I don't know.
Yeah.
But that wasn't his end point.
I totally agree with you.
However, even then, we might end up disagreeing with the theory of knowledge he constructs. But he didn't end up in saying we can't know anything.
Right.
That would be just the beginning, where we all start out. So What happens when you encounter that attitude, say in your professors, since we're talking, I'm thinking of young students, right, who are just coming to college, and you encounter a professor who just says, we can't know anything.
Yeah, well, we had those professors, and I think you have to say, all right, well, now that I'm under this person, I mean, I signed up for this class and this is what they're saying, you probably need to think critically about what's being taught there, but maybe perhaps not try to change them because they're your professor, and that's really difficult to do. But I think it's good to raise questions and to think about what are the assumptions that are driving this kind of skepticism.
Yeah.
What other assumptions are involved?
Yeah, that's the kind of advice I was thinking about for this episode. Was you sign up for a class, and your teacher, you believe A, and your teacher is teaching non-A, whatever those are. And they're maybe the immediate, I've seen maybe three different things that happen. One is, I'm out of here. I'm dropping out.
Yeah.
I'm not going to deal with this. And I've seen a lot of people who go into it, go into a philosophy degree, and they have very high expectations, and within about a year, they drop out.
Yeah.
Because of that. They don't want to deal with teachers who disagree with them. And the second attitude is, I'm going to change the teacher. I'll be the one who points out something the teacher had never thought of before. Now, that's highly unlikely, given the teacher's been doing this for a long time. You're probably just going to recycle things that they'd already heard. And so that doesn't go very far either. The third one is, I would suggest, take it as an opportunity to learn all you can about this view. So
yes.
You're asking questions, especially to draw out what are the assumptions of the view that you're being taught. And so it's a great opportunity to do that, to get, hopefully your teacher represents one of the best examples of whatever view they're presenting. So get out, use the opportunity to learn, what is this view?
Exactly. And I think if you have a grounding in the idea that knowledge is possible, then you can always gain knowledge from this experience. You do need to have tools in place, and hopefully we can maybe mention what those tools are as we go through this series. But you need to go into classes. I took a class called Skepticism, and I had to go into that class with some tools and some people I could go and talk to afterwards.
Yeah, that's really good to have a community to work together on this with.
Yeah.
But one of the things that this approach would do, using the class as an opportunity to learn, is illustrate something we've talked about before at Clarity Fund, which is how to think presuppositionally. So you could go in and just learn lots of facts, and that's helpful. But what I'm suggesting is you can learn about this view presuppositionally if you learn to ask the right kinds of questions. Then you'll go from not just this is kind of a scattered assortment of 100 facts about a position, but they're ordered back to basic questions, how this view answers certain basic questions. I know for both of us, those questions really attracted us at the beginning of our career in philosophy. But then as we got into, say, junior, senior, MA level studies, we realized, wow, they're not doing those things anymore.
Yeah, that's for sure. And so going back to what I just said, I think we had some assumptions going into our studies and some things that were settled fixed points that allowed for us to critically analyze what we were learning. And I do think, in my education at least, I was exposed to some of the best ideas presented in, let's say, the history of skepticism. I know skepticism from that class.
Yeah, exactly. So that's when I think that's where you and I would both want to start, is advice to a young philosophy student: learn to think presuppositionally by going back to basic questions. Philosophy is an area that asks basic questions that are assumed by all the other disciplines in the academy. And so physics, psychology, etc., assume answers to the kinds of questions philosophy asks, and you need to learn what those questions are, and then you can begin to identify how a given professor has answered those questions. And once you give an answer, it takes you in a certain direction, and you fill in a lot of the other answers to other kinds of questions. So usually the classes I had weren't about the basic questions, but they were about something else, some secondary or tertiary level question. And I had to trace it back myself and do that work myself. And sometimes if you ask the teachers about that, they resist that because they think you're going somewhere. So you have to maybe learn how to do that work yourself and just see, oh, okay, this class, which is about the philosophy of language, is studying 20th century logical positivists who assumed the following things.
Yeah, right. And, you know, this made me think of a couple other pieces. having a solid foundation and knowing the foundations before you go into upper division courses is really going to be helpful.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I'll pause there for a second.
Yeah, that's right. The foundation, that's what, going over philosophy as an area in the academy, and as an area, it asks foundational questions. And do you have those in place? There's always a concern at the university to trim the budget. And so any discipline that's not carrying its weight could be on the chopping block. And many times philosophy is on the list of possible disciplines, because what are you going to do with a philosophy degree? So in one way, we might have to make a defense, an apology for doing philosophy. And that's how I would begin, right? I would say, well, you can't, this is the one discipline you especially can't get rid of, because it's the original discipline in the academy, and it's the discipline that supplies the foundation for all the other disciplines.
Right, right.
So we can get into that. What are these foundational questions you guys are talking about?
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to get at, is if you have the foundations in place when you're in your beginning stages of a philosophy degree or study of philosophy, then you'll mature well. And so if you don't have the foundations in place, you may just get shaken, and that's where people turn away from their studies. They drop it off and leave it.
Yeah. So I've seen philosophy presented more like as a history of ideas,
mm-hmm.
which I know we both like. That's fascinating, but it's not philosophy. And a lot of times my philosophy classes were just the history of idea classes. So I had a class on theory of knowledge, and it was just studying different people's theory of knowledge. We didn't learn how do we get knowledge. It wasn't even on the table, because the assumption was no one knows that. You have really smart people who disagree about it. Let's just study their views, and that's the best the rest of us can ever hope to do. So that's more like a history class.
Yeah.
With built-in skepticism.
And that's funny, because that already has built-in assumptions. That we do philosophy this way assumes, you know, we really can't get to the answers that this whole history was searching for.
Right.
And we should say, well, why should I think that?
Yeah. Why should we start there? So, or it's taught as the history of, or philosophy could be a kind of argumentative class, right?
Mm-hmm.
Argumentation. So you learn, you're basically told there are no correct views, just learn the style of arguing. And so you pick a side, and your opponent has another side, and it could be random. I mean, you could just assign positions randomly. And then you learn the form of how to argue well. And that's interesting, because that's basically the very definition of sophism, which is what began, what motivated Socrates to say there must be more of that, because we must be able to actually have a truth of the matter, not just learning how to argue well. But a lot of what we see in the academy might be just a return to sophism.
That's true. And so I was just thinking, philosophy is really, I mean, we say this as a platitude, the love of wisdom, but that doesn't even seem to be on the radar anymore.
Yeah.
And so if you're starting off doing philosophy because you do love something about it, you have to figure out, what is that love? Is it rooted in the love of wisdom, which goes back to the love of knowledge? Am I going to see that in the courses that I take? And if I don't see that, am I going to get discouraged, or am I going to back up and say, no, I can use this as an opportunity to gain the very thing that they're saying I can't get?
Yeah. So it's sort of like a comparative argument. If this happened to Socrates, don't be surprised if it happens to you.
Exactly.
And what happened especially was that he encountered two types of persons, which we've talked about in previous episodes. And these are types or attitudes, as opposed to a name calling somebody. But the position of being a fool, who is someone who thinks they know and they don't know. And that's who Socrates mostly encountered. Then there's the other person, the simple, who doesn't care to know at all. So they might confess they don't know, and they also don't want to know.
Right. And which one's more likely to be in the position of being a professor? I hate to say it, but, you know, we have to think that way sometimes.
Well, yeah. Well, and just in the sense, we're using this analogy to Socrates. So someone said, oh, Dr. Anderson and Dr. Burton are saying this. Well, we're getting this out of the apology, right? So the professors in the apology who said they know things, Socrates went to them and asked if they know or they only think they know. And so what you'll encounter a lot of times, though, is the professor might say, yeah, not only don't I know, but no one can know. That's the skepticism. And I think that'll be the main challenge. I know that in the next episodes, you and I will probably be talking about how one thing you don't want to do is accept skepticism and then make it part of your answer. That's just fideism.
Right.
So that's what we might have seen in a lot of the last in the rise of philosophy of religion over the past few decades may have just been another kind of skepticism. They might have said, well, the materialists are skeptics, so we can be skeptics too.
And that assumes the very thing the materialists are assuming. We can't know. And so then the philosophers of religion say, yeah, we can't know, but if we go down that road, then we lose meaning. And so in order to preserve some kind of meaning, we have to just believe. But why should we assume that we can't know? We aren't backing up and asking that question. And I've been telling my students this, that question is not going to go away. It's going to be part of the epistemological debt that they inherit. And we'll just keep pushing it forward until somebody addresses that.
Yeah. Or what they'll probably encounter is, it might be refreshingly rare if someone says we can't know anything. What they'll probably encounter is a redefinition of the term know. So they'll say, well, we don't know some things, but we know like historical facts, or we know the gravitational force. And so that's why what we'll do in a philosophy class is really just history of philosophy, because we know what Descartes said, we know what Locke said, we know what Aquinas said, but we don't actually know the answers. We just know their answers. And so you and I are going to spend some time defining, well, what does it mean to know? And I think we both use a Socratic model as an example. So we're not just pulling this out of thin air, but we're saying, no, from the beginning, Socrates wanted to know what something is. So what is wisdom? Or what is the good? And come to have knowledge, and if you did have knowledge, you could show that you know.
Right.
You have maybe a good word that helps illustrate that is understanding. If you understood wisdom, then you'd be able to show us that you understand it.
Yeah, and that's a kind of demonstration. And sometimes we learn about demonstrations are through arguments in philosophy. Perhaps, though, arguments don't get us to knowledge, so we have to learn what is the proper way of demonstrating that we understand to show that we do know.
Yeah. Well, and one way we'll do that, and the way we can sort of conclude the next few minutes for this episode is, we were saying that philosophy is an area that gives foundation and answers foundational questions, and I suggested that the way to think about a challenging class is presuppositionally, which means you work back from, say, logical positivism to the basic, how does logical positivism answer these basic questions? So both of those, thinking presuppositionally and getting to philosophy as an area, requires identifying those. So those are the following. How do I know? That's the starting question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because any other answer I give presupposes I know things. I know my answer. And then the second one is, I'm knowing about what's real. That's what I want to know about. What is real? What has existed from eternity? What is changing and temporal? And then from there we go to, what is the good? What is the purpose and highest goal at which all things aim? So those are three basic questions in the areas of epistemology, metaphysics, and ethics. And a lot of times a philosophy class may not be structured to tell you what their answers are. And so part of the challenge, and part of what I kind of found as fun, was trying to figure out, how is this viewpoint answering those questions?
Yeah, that is the fun part.
So I use logical positivism just as one example because of its prevalence in the 20th century and because it was used to say that religion was done. We know belief in God is over. And the latter part of the 20th century saw a resurgence in philosophy of religion, which disproved that, at least statistically disproved this claim by logical positivism. People still were doing belief in God. And so part of the challenge is, yeah, what did the logical positivists think about reality? And how do they come to this materialism that they held? So, and why did that collapse? So being able to see this position is claiming all things are material, and that's not a new position. That's an ancient view in the history of philosophy. Really, that's the first Greek philosophers were materialists, and precisely because of the weakness of that view is why we have Plato and Aristotle, because they pointed out, look, it can't be the case that all is matter, and that gave them their prominence in the history of philosophy.
Yeah. Can I point something out?
No.
We've been emphasizing the analytic tradition in philosophy, but we also should take into consideration the continental tradition and how that leads to what we could call postmodernism. And they may not be as explicit in their assumptions about metaphysics and the good life. They may say, well, we really can't know those things, and have assumptions about them still. They explicitly say we abandon metaphysics, but they don't really do that. So it takes a little more work to see what are the assumptions and how are they playing out in in these other areas.
Yeah, right. So someone could say we don't need to answer these questions that you're saying. We have our own questions. And so I think there's a kind of sense in which these are inescapable, and they come out in what we could call self-referential absurdities, which is when you try to deny them, you're still using them. And so we might see that pattern come up a few times where someone says, I don't need to use reason, but in doing that, they're using reason. Or I don't need to answer how we know things, and in doing that, they're giving you an answer about how they know things. So that comes up a lot, and it's part of self-knowledge to see yourself doing that and learn, oh, why am I doing that? Why am I contradicting myself there? So I think that would be interesting. I think you and I will probably be able, maybe we can have an episode, do some short histories of some of these movements, right?
Right.
Existentialism, analytic philosophy. Right now, those are kind of the two schools.
Yes.
It reminds me of when the Apostle Paul went to Athens and he talked to the philosophers at Mars Hill, and they too were divided into two schools, the Stoics and the Epicureans. These had come down to them and they were sharing an assumption. They both were materialists of a kind, but they disagreed about what the good life is, if it's virtue or happiness. And what the Apostle Paul did was he raised questions. He blew up their position by raising questions about assumptions they held. So if you look at what he said, he raises some problems with their materialism and gets back to things that are clear about God.
Yeah.
So what he does in this chapter, Acts 17, illustrates what he says in Romans 1, that the eternal power and divine nature of God are clearly seen in the things that are made. So he says that in Romans 1, and then in Acts 17, you see him illustrating that and how he speaks to the philosophers. And so I think that's a good model for us as well, as we're thinking about, well, how do we approach these other views? And so there they were stuck in Epicureanism and Stoicism. Here they may be stuck in analytic and continental philosophy, but it's a similar kind of problem.
Right. And we need a similar kind of approach.
Yeah, we can learn that. And this illustration of thinking presuppositionally, he doesn't say, hey, I'm going to start thinking presuppositionally. But as you look at what he's doing, he's saying, he's bringing up problems with their assumptions that they may not be aware of their own assumptions. And he has to bring those up and show them what they could know if they were thinking about these things.
Yes.
So challenges that we're facing in philosophy, and advice, as we're suggesting some advice to young philosophers, young philosophy students, and especially thinking about challenges that might come up for young Christian philosophy students, as we are wanting to study the basic questions in philosophy. And two old philosophers?
I guess.
Two oldish philosophers suggesting these ideas for mentoring.
Yeah.
So thanks for joining us in this episode, and we'll see you next time.
See you.